Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
So we've adopted an every-week format which I pretentiously call dualities to frame the discussion we'll have. The reason I call them dualities is because I believe that more than anything else, it's the divided self, the tensions between our ideals and our realities that create new thoughts. Perhaps these thoughts are no better than the thoughts before, perhaps they inadvertently create their own dualities, or perhaps these dualities lead us right back to where we were before. Sometimes there are not two sides to every issue, but three or four, necessitating trialities or quadralities, and sometimes there is only one side to an issue because any argument against it people have come up with so far is bullshit, and those are therefore monalities. But for the moment, this tension between poles seems like the best way to frame our discussions. So here are the dualities for this week. Just two. The two Machiavellis and Groucho versus Margaret Dumont. So first, the two Machiavellis. As I was planning this week's podcast, recorded both in Baltimore and San Francisco, I realized that I didn't have quite enough material for a third podcast on Machiavelli, but I had a little bit of material left over that would frame the discussion for the next few weeks a little too perfectly. It's probably the subject that any podcast about politics or history inevitably has to get to at this moment of American life, the battle of the sexes, and particularly how it's been framed as a battle by Hollywood. So I want to do that by talking this week and next week about two classic movies which you could have seen in the last 2 weeks around Baltimore, and then in the weeks after, movies of the most recent release dates. But before we do that, if you'll indulge me, two passages from the penultimate chapter of The Prince, short ones, you may be stunned by how perfectly Machiavelli frames our discussion for future weeks. Not to extinguish our free will, I hold it to be true that fortune is the arbiter of one half our actions, but that she leaves us still to direct the other half, or perhaps a little less. I compare her to one of those raging rivers which, when in flood, overflows the plains, sweeping away trees and buildings, bearing away the soil from place to place. Everything flies before it, all yield to its violence without being able in any way to withstand it. And yet, though its nature be such, it does not follow that men, when the weather becomes fair, shall not make provision, both with defences and barriers, in such a manner that, rising again, the waters may pass away by canal, and their force be neither so unrestrained nor so dangerous. So it happens with Fortune, who shows her power where valour has not prepared to resist her, and thither she turns her forces where she knows that barriers and forces have not been raised to constrain her. This is the Machiavelli whom I think is of genuine use to the world. Yes, he thinks like a mafioso. But at the turn of the 15th century, thinking like a mafioso was an astonishingly forward-thinking notion. Everybody was being ruthless anyway, so you might as well redirect your ruthlessness towards the long-term goal of stability. Machiavelli always refers to fortune as a feminine thing, likening fortune to an ebbing or flowing river. This ebb and flow of a river, the slipperiness of the bank, the violent floods that bring about rebirth, the drinkability that gives life to people, animals, and plants, seems to have a kind of feminine connotation in mythology. On the other hand, seas, with their undrinkable saltiness which never seem to move from one place, their wrathful storms, their waves that move consistently, and tides that are predictable, seem to be portrayed as masculine gods. Think of Poseidon or Lear in Celtic mythology or the Dragon Kings of the Four Seas in Chinese mythology. But Celtic mythology has at least four different river goddesses. Indian mythology has three, at least. Satis was, at least in late ancient Egypt, the Egyptian Nile goddess, who brought about the annual flooding of the Nile and therefore the destruction that enables rebirth. Or remember how, at least in the movie of the Grapes of Wrath, Mama Jode likens a woman's view of life to an ebbing and flowing river. This masculine-feminine duality with seas and rivers is obviously not consistent. The most obvious example is Poseidon, who seems to be the CEO of all bodies of water, and Greek mythology is intricate and androgynous enough that there are masculine gods of everything and just as many goddesses of everything, too. But in all of these mythologies, the male water gods seem to have more power than the women, each of whom seems to control but one river, while Poseidon and Lear get every sea everywhere. Apparently, even in ancient times, there was a 23% pay gap. But this archetypal and, by modern ears, stereotypical world of myth is where Machiavelli draws his feminine metaphor for fortune. And Machiavelli's readers would know that Fortuna is the Roman goddess of fortune, luck, and fate. So by modern standards, this description here is a little bit sexist, but not stunningly so. And here's the quote. "So it happens with fortune, who shows her power where valor has not prepared to resist her, and thither she turns her forces where she knows that barriers and forces have not been raised to constrain her." This is a little sexist, obviously. This is a sentence that likens women to the manipulative temptress who tries to break through your defenses. But at least this quote is not about a man breaking through a woman's defenses. So I'm not sure this would qualify as sexist by anything but the standards of the 21st century. Now, the reason to talk about Machiavelli in a podcast that is frankly about classic Hollywood is because in some ways he is a moralist whose words we have to heed in our own time. Machiavelli is helpful to us today not because he advised against evil and morality, but because by advising a kind of indifference to traditional morality, because a greater long-term morality was at stake that could provide greater dividends of peace in the future. Machiavelli was, in some ways at least, the first thinker to realize that the greatest danger to the world, then as now, was fanaticism. The moral certainty that you are right and what you believe is the incontrovertible truth, and therefore everyone who disagrees with you is morally inferior to you. Machiavelli says, and I'm interpolating obviously, don't focus on what seems immediately right, focus on what is practical. Before Machiavelli, discussions of politics were grounded in the Greeks, who focused not on the practicalities of governance, but on ascertaining what's the ideal forms of government. Only in Machiavelli do we see a politician instructed to delay gratification, put his ideals or pleasures as a long-term goal rather than something that can be achieved immediately. And it can't be a complete coincidence that Machiavelli came up with his ideas in the same period that mankind finally began what, in our lifetime at least, seems like a permanent advance out of the Dark Ages. But then there is the other Machiavelli, whom we've not talked about too much in the last 2 weeks, the much more famous Machiavelli, who still shocks the world with his ruthlessness, whose medievalism can never be doubted, and who says, and I quote, "For my part, I consider that it is better to be adventurous than cautious, because fortune is a woman, and if you wish to keep her under, it is necessary to beat and ill-use her. And it is seen that she allows herself to be mastered by the adventurous rather than by those who go to work more coldly. She is, therefore, always womanlike, a lover of young men because they are less cautious, more violent, and with more audacity command her." This passage is shocking today. The idea that it's necessary to beat women is obviously incredibly shocking, but still more shocking is the euphemistic ill-use, because in thinking about it for less than a second, we can pretty much guess what kind of ill-use Machiavelli meant. And don't think this was completely unshocking at the time, when laws of honor were supposed to prohibit such conduct in courtly circles, or at least let people be in denial when ladies of high birth were treated that way. So here we are, 500 years later, faced in our time with the extremely uncomfortable truth for many of us various forms of liberals, that for the better part of this half millennium, these liberal notions of individual rights and security were still only meant to accommodate a very small class of people. And the state of everybody else was barely any better than animals, perhaps treated worse than animals because of how much utility their lords could derive from their productivity. Does this invalidate liberalism? Does it make liberalism an antiquated notion? Many people would argue that it does, that liberalism is a sham that allows injustice to be perpetrated from century to century when what we need is solutions now before more people die and suffer. But nothing tried yet has nearly so productive a track record. But at the same time, you'd have to be willfully blind to understand people's lack of patience with liberalism's gradual and always shifting and ebbing reforms, or even their insistence that liberalism is all a superstructure or a myth meant to blind people to the reality of how people suffer from it. So this brings us to our second duality, Margaret versus Groucho. I think it was while I watched President Groucho Marx bounce a ball against his desk while the cabinet of Fredonia looked on for an indefinite amount of time that I became convinced that Duck Soup is the most eerily prescient movie ever made for our historical moment. Here's a clip from a truly fantastic video log everybody should bookmark, 100 Years of Cinema. Listen to how it describes Groucho in this movie. I would try to say all this myself, but he captures it so perfectly that I could never do it half so well.
Duck Soup came out in 1933, the same year that Hitler was elected as Chancellor in Germany. And Ruthless T. Firefly is a grotesque parody of the typical authoritarian leader. Firefly's power is bought with cash rather than with votes.
I will lend the money to Fredonia only if Firefly is appointed leader.
He's mean.
Don't look now, but there's one man too many in this room, and I think it's you.
He ignores the government and posts his friends to positions of power.
Now let's see. How would you like a job in the Mint?
Mint? No. I don't like a Mint. What other flavor you got?
He's incompetent.
Look at them run. Now they know they've been in a war.
Your Excellency!
They're fleeing like rats.
But sir, I've got the truth.
Remind me to give myself the Firefly medal for this.
Your Excellency, you're shooting your own men.
And he makes sure that his mistakes are covered.
Here's $5. Keep it under your hat. Never mind, I'll keep it under my hat.
He's so driven by paranoia and so war-hungry that he forgoes democracy and drives his country to war with an aggressive show of strength.
I'd be only too happy to meet Ambassador Trentino and offer him on behalf of my country the right hand of good fellowship. And I feel sure that he will accept this gesture in the spirit in which it is offered. But suppose he doesn't. A fine thing that'll be. I hold out my hand and he refuses to accept it.
So, you refuse to shake hands with me, eh?
He holds corrupt trials and ignores the law to benefit his friends.
My friends, this man's case moves me deeply. Look at Ciccolini. He sits there alone. An abject figure.
I object.
And when the war starts, we see it for all of its absurdity. The great leader is blind to military tactics. The help is useless.
Hurry on, men! Help is on the way!
And the political elite are held in relative safety while enlisted men are sent to their deaths.
There was a New Yorker cartoon last year that showed, well, I forget which founding fathers, but two of them, and one said to the other, "What if a potential tyrant rises up, but nobody can stop him because it's kind of funny?" So Donald Trump turned out to be exactly as authoritarian in outlook as we feared, but our saving grace is that he also turned out to be the dumbest man on the planet. Our American system knows exactly how to deal with demagoguery, but it presupposes that the demagogue is an intelligent, educated man duping a public less intelligent than he. The founders had no conception of how to get rid of a man-child puppet of another dictatorship who may be suffering from dementia, and while he's in a bad mood, might order a nuclear attack while his chief of staff is asleep. The Marx brothers were actual brothers, and one gets the sense in the routines of all three of them, particularly in The Silent Harpo, that their routines are just extensions of the ways they annoyed each other as children. At the time, the mirror scene between Groucho and Harpo was thought of as revolutionary, but it's hard to believe that every person didn't do something like the mirror routine at some point in their childhoods. Or think of the scenes when Harpo drives the street vendor crazy by switching his hat when the vendor isn't looking, and think to yourself how many times childhood friends or siblings would try to pull that trick on you when you were 10. Harpo is a silent clown, but more importantly, he's basically an overgrown child whose routines are literally to annoy the people around him until they go absolutely insane. Groucho, on the other hand, is like our president, stuck in adolescence. While he does it 1,000 times better than just about any teenager, Groucho's the class clown. And like our president, the usual subject of his jokes are women whom he seems to hate and fear almost savagely.
Will you do me a favor and stop yelling my name all over this restaurant? Do I go around yelling your name?
Mr. Driftwood!
Say, is your voice changing or is somebody else paging me around here?
Mr. Driftwood!
Why, Mrs. Claypool, hello!
Mr. Driftwood, you invited me to dine with you at 7 o'clock. It is now 8 o'clock and no dinner.
What do you mean, no dinner? I just had one of the biggest meals I ever ate in my life, and no thanks to you either.
I've been sitting right here since 7 o'clock.
Yes, with your back to me. When I invite a woman to dinner, I expect her to look at my face. That's the price she has to pay.
Your check, sir.
$9.40? This is an outrage. If I were you, I wouldn't pay it. Now then, Mrs. Claypool, what are we going to have for dinner?
You've had your dinner.
All right, we'll have breakfast. Waiter,
Yes, sir.
Have you got any milk, fat chicken?
Yes, sir.
Well, squeeze the milk out. I want to bring me a glass.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Driftwood, 3 months ago, you promised to put me into society. In all that time, you've done nothing but draw a very handsome salary.
You think that's nothing, huh? How many men do you suppose are drawing a handsome salary nowadays? Why, you can count them on the fingers of one hand, my good woman.
I'm not your good woman.
Don't say that, Mrs. Claypool. I don't care what your past has been. To me, you'll always be my good woman, because I love you. There. I didn't mean to tell you, but you dragged it out of me. I love you.
It's rather difficult to believe that when I find you dining with another woman.
That woman? Do you know why I sat with her? Because no. She reminded me of you.
Really?
Of course. That's why I'm sitting here with you. Because you remind me of you. Your eyes, your throat, your lips. Everything about you reminds me of you. Except you. How do you account for that? If she figures that one out, she's good.
Mr. Driftwood, I think we'd better keep everything on a business basis.
How do you like that? Every time I get romantic with you, you want to talk business. I don't know. There's something about me that brings out the business in every woman.
Next to Groucho in a dozen movies stands Margaret Dumont, the wealthy old dowager, more than 3 inches taller than Groucho when in heels, supremely confident, sublimely pompous, and unfathomably stupid. Standing next to Groucho in every Marx Brothers movie purely to be the object of Groucho's abuse and show us that there is no just world in which a wealthy idiot like her is considered an aristocrat, while this Oscar Wilde, who seems to have glommed onto her from a street corner, is considered an upstart. And so was the way of the world in 1933, when it was correctly seen as a given that the Margaret Dumonts of the world were in such an unassailable position that they could absorb every jibe and taunt and scoff and sneer, because her mind was so slow that she couldn't even process half of them. And even if she got them, what did it matter? She was blue-blooded and rich. Groucho might have been a man, but he was the child of immigrants from a poor and low-class background and Jewish. Did it matter in 1933 that the Grouchos of the world was the one invincible weapon they'd have at their disposal to even the playing field a bit against the Margaret Dumonts?
Oh, Your Excellency! We've been expecting you. As chairwoman of the reception committee, I extend the good wishes of every man, woman, and child of Fredonia.
Never mind that stuff. Take a card.
Card? What'll I do with the card?
You can keep it. I've got 51 left. Now, what were you saying?
As chairwoman of the reception committee, I welcome you with open arms.
Is that so? How late do you stay open?
I've sponsored your appointment because I feel you are the most able statesman in all Fredonia.
Well, that covers a lot of ground. Say, you cover a lot of ground yourself. You better beat it. I hear they're going to tear you down and put up an office building where you're standing. You can leave in a taxi. If you can't get a taxi, you can leave in a huff. If that's too soon, you can leave in a minute and a huff. You know you haven't stopped talking since I came here? You must have been vaccinated with a phonograph needle.
The future of Fredonia rests on you. Promise me you'll follow in the footsteps of my husband.
How do you like that? I haven't been on the job 5 minutes and already she's making advances to me. Not that I care, but where is your husband?
Why, he's dead.
I'll bet he's just using that as an excuse.
I was with him till the very end.
No wonder he passed away.
I held him in my arms and kissed him.
Oh, I see. Then it was murder. Will you marry me? Did he leave you any money? Answer the second question first.
He left me his entire fortune.
Is that so? Can't you see what I'm trying to tell you? I love you.
Oh, Your Excellency.
You're not so bad yourself.
Taking Groucho Marx to task for his ribbing of women is a bit like taking Roosevelt to task for the Japanese internment camps. Both are absolutely true. Both should be criticized for it. Both are figures of roughly equal importance to the world around 1940, and I mean that completely. And pointing this out neglects that between them, FDR and Groucho might have done more to break open the doors to more equitable social classes than any two men in world history, including those who shared their last names. The year of duck soup is 1933, the same year that Hitler came to power, and of all the volleys in the Jewish invasion of world culture, the Marx Brothers were, are, and probably will always be our single most important. In the same way that race, sex, and gender permeates nearly everything in our zeitgeist, 1933 was permeated with questions of social class, and the Marx Brothers were an atomic bomb that went off in the world's sense of propriety. It was also 5 years after sound came to Hollywood, and no film director, not even Howard Hawks or Billy Wilder, could pace his scenes at the fever pitch of Groucho riffing one zinger after another after another. Groucho had some of the greatest American writers and comics of his time pitching in on his dialogue, former household names like George S. Kaufman and S.J. Perlman. But Groucho was just as quick and on his feet as his writers. Here is probably the most famous ad-lib line in television history.
Why do you have so many children?
Because I like my wife.
I like my cigar, too, but I take it out sometimes.
Before Groucho, the list of unmentionables in polite society was 100 times longer. No doubt the excess propriety of high society evolved because the world required a way of freeing itself from the grime and shit of that appallingly vulgar thing, nature, to which we animals once were slaves. But after the Industrial Revolution, when the world became mechanized, we can begin to reclaim the natural rawness we'd relinquished amid all that refinement. When vulgarity can have as much wit as Groucho Marx, it becomes clear that Groucho is the natural aristocrat, while Margaret Dumont is the natural peasant. It's not like the Marx brothers came up with the idea of the lowly street hustlers tearing high society to pieces, but no one tore into high society as savagely as Groucho did. And so many of the rituals of high society were based on a show of excessive deference to women and to their virtue. Groucho Marx clearly did not believe in virtue or deference. 85 years before President Trump, Groucho was America's linguistic id, saying all the destructive things out loud which popped into his head, which was obviously much smarter than Donald Trump ever was on his least demented day. The Marx brothers were primal agents of chaos, and the purpose of their very existence seemed to be to blow up well-ordered high societies. And if Groucho Marx could be celebrated for saying things that were not necessarily mentioned in polite company, so then could his millions of admirers. But 85 years later, it's impossible to look around and not realize that the same populist urge which tore down the prison which respectability trapped us now threatens to tear down respectability itself. The world now is so populist in every way, political and cultural, that the most immediate enemy to us is no longer excessive reverence, but precisely its opposite, excessive irreverence. And just as the world was once obsessed with elite notions of social class, either ascending to a higher class or abolishing all notions of social class, the world today is obsessed with its polar opposite, equality. Whether it was made this way by Karl Marx or Groucho Marx, the field of play is now seen as so level, the difference in people's inherent merits so slight, that even if, though it's true that all men and women are created equal and owed the same inalienable rights, we can't be surprised that these rights result in hatred and fury, since people disagree so vociferously about what those inalienable rights should be. In America, the right says that these inalienable rights are economic and religious. The left says that these rights are related to social justice. The right thinks we should have the right to be free from government interference on our economy. The left thinks we should have the right to expect the government to provide us with prosperity. The left thinks government has no right to interfere about whom we marry and or whether or not women get abortions. The right thinks that government has every right to interfere on such questions. The traditional right wing of America has always thought, as traditional right wingers always have, that politeness and decency should place limits on the sentiments we're allowed to express. Any sentiment that questions traditional authority, family, government, the church, sex, is something they would rather not permit. As with any other era, it's an impossible standard to uphold, but all the more so in our era when information spreads so rapidly. And we now live in an era so revolutionary that it's the left who believes that politeness and decency should place limits on the sentiments we're allowed to express. The sentiments that are off limits are no longer sentiments that question traditional authority, but the sentiments which uphold them. Questions of race, gender, sexuality. Is this a good or bad development? Well, like any ideology, it holds us to an impossible standard. But that's almost immaterial to the point at hand. For the point at hand is this. Think of how greatly the world has changed since Richard Nixon, who hid his evil deeds behind a veneer of excessive reverence for tradition. In the 49 years since President Nixon's inauguration, the left so thoroughly won the battle to liberate us from the constraints of tradition that the idea that we should be free to express whatever sentiment we wish, no matter how objectionable, is now a conservative argument, not a liberal one. The American right is so unrecognizably changed from its traditional trappings that they can unhesitatingly support and champion a man who openly celebrates his duplicity, his arrogance, his greed, and his lust. We now live in a world in which debates on political correctness have reached such an unbelievable fever pitch that Donald Trump has been elected purely because of his persona as a man who will say the things everybody is thinking but afraid to say. Groucho's character in Duck Soup, Rufus T. Firefly, was meant to be an irreverent parody of right-wing authoritarian rulers who hide behind this excessive reverence. But now he's a prediction.
He'll be here any moment.
Mrs. Teasdale, you did a noble deed. I'd be unworthy of the high trust that's been placed in me if I didn't do everything within my power to keep our beloved Fredonia at peace with the world. I'd be only too happy to meet Ambassador Trentino and offer him, on behalf of my country, the right hand of good fellowship. And I feel sure that he will accept this gesture in the spirit in which it is offered. But suppose he doesn't. A fine thing that'll be. I hold out my hand and he refuses to accept it. That'll add a lot to my prestige, won't it? Me, the head of a country, snubbed by a foreign ambassador. Who does he think he is, that he can come here and make a sap out of me in front of all my people? Think of it. I hold out my hand, and that hyena refuses to accept it. Why, the cheap, four-flushing swine, he'll never get away with it, I tell you. He'll never get away with it.
Please.
So, you refuse to shake hands with me, eh?
Mrs. Caesar, this is the last straw. There's no turning back now. This means war.
The debate over political correctness is now charged as perhaps never before, but as a term, it's used almost exclusively by the people allegedly opposed to it. The term goes all the way back to the Soviet Union in the 1920s, when it was a term of approval. Is he politically correct? Is a way of asking if a person towed the party line. Whether used by the hard left as a term of pride, or the hard right as a term of derision, the term was always a bit of a red herring, designed to smash apart the effectiveness of other party lines so as to promote your own. When the term politically correct was used as a cudgel by Donald Trump or Ann Coulter or Alan Bloom before them, it was rarely used in American discourse as anything but a means to batter down a different form of political correctness, the better to install your own form. For real liberals, the left's insistence on political correctness has always been a genuine problem. But compared to so many other problems, not least the political correctness of the right, it's been roughly number 150 down the list of problems in American life. But even if quote-unquote political correctness has always been so far down our list of problems, our long list of problems, the question still remains, if with all the events and protests and rancor of the last 2 years, the best that has happened is that Hollywood and journalism are just a little bit safer from slimy sexists, and the worst that's happened is that Donald Trump is president, we all have to ask ourselves if this new exclusionism is worth a price tag that often seems astronomical and like we've only begun to start paying it. Whatever the truth of the matter, the Obama presidency was possible because a large part of America embraced a candidate whose message was that we are a United States of America. This country may have come out of the Obama years more divided than ever before, certainly since the Civil War. But by extending the hand just long enough to get a few moderates on our side, our president saved us from a second Great Depression, passed near universal health care, made gay marriage a national right, made hate crimes a federal offense, protected 5 million illegal immigrants from deportation, and helped them get work permits. "We are the ones we've been waiting for" is one of the greatest sentences any president has ever uttered, and its meanings are almost infinite. It's not just a call to radical action. It's a call to embrace people different from you, to win them over, to give a little to them so they can give you a lot, and to forgive those opponents who show even the smallest amount of contrition and compromise, so that we can attain as much of which we yearn as is humanly possible, rather than cling to ideals whose cause we would set back by not taking what we can get. This is the difference between radically inclusive Obama-era pragmatism and the status quo exclusionism of Trump and Sanders-era radicalism. So who can deny that we're in a new era now? In an era when the most obvious enemy was the people who suppress your speech, it's easy to know who the villain is. But in our fake news era, when so many enemies want to make speech so free that you hear nothing but a chaos of voices so that you cling only to the voices that sound in concert with yours, it's much harder to know who the villain is, and you at least begin to entertain the idea that people who demand a few curtailments on liberty in the name of equality might be on your side.
Much of what happens, what is discovered now, will of course be secret.
This has been It's Not Even Past, A History of the Distant Present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find these and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?